You are now listening to the Hack My Age podcast, the show that brings you guests for the woman going through the menopause journey. I'm your host, Zora Benamou, a gerontologist, certified sports nutrition, menopause, and breathing coach. I'm the author of The Longevity Master Plan and the cookbook Eating for Longevity. And if you're a woman in perimenopause or postmenopause, check out the programs on the hackmyage.com website to biohack and optimize your menopause experience, because menopause is inevitable, but suffering is optional. So now please head on over to Apple Podcasts or Spotify to subscribe to the podcast and leave a review to help others find us too. This is a really important point because it costs nothing, but makes a huge impact for me to support a podcast from menopausal women to normalize this conversation about menopause and attract even more amazing guests to the show for you and for me. I've got an offer you want to act fast on. We're having another guided group session for the Menopause Energy Reboot Program. I'm leading you on this four-week journey to biohack menopause starting February 4th, 2024. So join me and six other experts in the fields of hormones, intimacy, nutrition, sleep, and so much more. And I only take 20 women at a time to really get intimate, to solve your individual menopause issues. And for you, my faithful listener, you get 10% off with the code HACKMYAGE. So sign up now to claim your spot on the website by going to hackmyage.com/energy reboot. And I'll see you on the 4th. Hey there, biohacking besties. If you're navigating perimenopause or just dealing with those pesky menopause symptoms like hot flashes, fatigue, unexplained weight gain, you're not alone. I get it. The struggles with belly fat, crappy sleep, a racing mind, thinning hair, and that all too familiar feeling of anxiety or mood swings. Or maybe you've just experienced those mysterious symptoms like phantom smells, itchy skin, and achy joints. And these are all signs that you may be heading into the menopause transition. Yep, even if you're only 40. And it's not even rare to have these symptoms in your 30s, so just be aware. But here's the scoop. Menopause may be inevitable, but suffering is completely optional. You don't have to just tough it out because it's a natural process that women have endured for centuries. Yes, it's natural, but no, you don't have to tolerate the pain anymore. And that's why I've created specialized menopause biohacking programs just for you. This is not the usual recommendations like get a fan and dress in layers. We are talking about biohacks, which go beyond what most people even heard of to treat menopause symptoms. So head over to the hackmyage.com website and snag the hot flash program or the energy reboot program to hack your fatigue and optimize your menopause transition. And whether you prefer self-guided, affordable masterclasses or fully guided programs with a supportive community of women and me who are facing similar challenges, we have got you covered. Our next group session kicks off on February 4th, 2024, and here's a little treat for our fabulous listeners. You get an exclusive 10% off any program with the code HACKMYAGE. So got to act fast, especially if you want a spot in the guided program, because we keep it intimate with a maximum of 20 women to give you the attention you deserve. And if you're tuning in after that due date, no worries, just shoot me a message and I'll make a special offer just for you. So don't let menopause dictate your journey. Let's conquer it together and head over to the Hack My Age website now and start biohacking menopause. You can now watch all of our podcast interviews on the Hack My Age YouTube channel. Some of our guests bring slideshows, so it's really great to have. Every week, there is a new video, so just search Hack My Age on YouTube.com or find the link on the Hack My Age website. Hello, Age Disruptors. Today, I'm recording this podcast with a live studio audience. All of you attending this recording now are members of the Hack My Age VIP program. And part of being in this exclusive club is the ability to dial in and watch the interviews as they are recorded. And you can ask your own questions.
If you want to be a part of this amazing community, go to patreon.com. That's patreon.com/hackmyage and sign up not only for these cool interviews, but so much more.
Today's podcast is sponsored by the Institute of Bioidentical Medicine, which is the authority when it comes to understanding bioidentical hormones. And right now, I am in the middle of taking their menopause method course, and I am so impressed. This is a self-paced course designed by Dr. David Rosensweet, who's been treating women going through menopause for nearly 3 decades. I can highly recommend this program, particularly if you are a doctor or someone who's actually prescribing hormones to women for menopause. And if you're not, that's okay. Make an appointment at iobim.org to find out more about the program to see if you're a candidate for the menopause method. And ask for a discount with the code ZORA, Z-O-R-A. And if you're just looking for a qualified doctor who's highly trained in menopause medicine, check out their sister site, brite.live. Empower yourself with information and a doctor that you can trust, because menopause is inevitable, but suffering is optional.
So I am thrilled to have Dr. Sarah Ballantyne on the podcast, finally. And I've been following her for years, and she's got incredible content to share. And she's not only a best-selling author, but she is a medical biophysicist who is a really great educator to literally millions of people. And she believes that the key to improving public health is scientific literacy. And she makes us aware of the harm of healthism, diet culture, dogmatic misinformation, and predatory marketing. This happens a lot in the menopause space too, so that we can make the most informed choices. And what you may not know about Dr. Sarah is that she is also a very dedicated mother, and she loves to cook, and she's an artist, and she even enjoys to perform stand-up comedy. So she's got right and left brain on fire. And you can see all of this beautifully tied together in her social media channels, all with the handle name Dr. Sarah Ballantyne. And I'll include that in the show notes. So she's certainly a very multi-talented woman. And her latest project is called Nutrivore. And this is a relatively new website where we can find a positive and inclusive approach to dietary guidance based on science and devoid of dogma. And she uses nutrient density and sufficiency as its basic principles. And we're going to talk about exactly what this means, what is Nutrivore, and how this applies to a woman going through menopause. But before we do, I have to read the fancy disclaimer that the information provided on this podcast and in any other communications from or provided through us is not intended as a substitute for, nor does it replace, professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. So now, without that out of the way, let's meet Dr. Sarah Ballantyne. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So there's just so much to talk about today, and you know so much, not only about nutrition, you know about autoimmune disease and diets and healthism, misinformation. You got tons of information, interests, and experience under your belt. But let's just share a little bit about you and yourself and how you became interested in nutrition in the first place, and then we'll move on.
Yeah, I came at nutrition sort of from the side. So my training as a medical researcher involved studying the innate immune system in critical care medicine. I did do a little bit of cancer research towards the end of my research career, but I was mostly focused on, you know, understanding these situations where the immune system kind of goes out of control, not realizing that it was very relevant to my own health struggles. I was collecting autoimmune disease diagnoses like they were stamps at the time, and it would have been much cooler to collect stamps. I was obese, and I just had so many symptoms that were eroding quality of life. And when my first daughter was born, I also developed gestational diabetes in that pregnancy, and I was in bad shape. And so I decided to take some time off of medical research, ostensibly to focus on motherhood, but it ended up also giving me the space to focus on myself. And my first my first steps in my own health journey were losing 100 pounds using a low carb diet, which fixed some of the things that I was struggling with and made some of the things I was struggling with worse. And it wasn't until I started like really thinking about the skin conditions I had at the time. Have two autoimmune diseases that affect the skin, psoriasis and lichen planus. And then I was also struggling with eczema. And I like stumbled, right? I was like doing what we all do. I was consulting with Dr. Google. And I stumbled on a website that sort of talked about food sensitivities and how those can cause eczema or worsen eczema. And I went, huh, I wonder if that could be linked with the other things that are going on with me. And that was the first, like, earliest beginnings of me using my background as a medical researcher and applying my scientific knowledge to the problem of my own health. That brought me into the, you know, paleo diet community, the autoimmune protocol, which I have since moved on from, embracing a permissive dietary structure rather than a restrictive one. But the even that part of my journey to building Nutrabor was still me following the science and being confronted with the scientific evidence showing that I was wrong about some things and that I was potentially eliminating foods that I didn't need to be. And so a large part of my journey over the last 4 years building Nutrabor has also been a health, like the next phase of my own health journey, and really not just looking at my physical health, which is how this all started, but also my mental and emotional relationship with food. And so for me, Nutrabor is as much about understanding what nutrients do in the body and what foods contain what nutrients, how much of those nutrients we need, how to combine different foods to get the full range of nutrients our bodies need, and building that knowledge base for people to be able to apply the Nutrabor philosophy to their preferred diet or anti-diet. It's as much about that as it has been for me healing from an eating disorder I didn't really realize that I had, and really being able to like face my food fears and work on expanding my diet and get to a place where I no longer categorize foods as good or bad, and instead look for the nutritional value in all foods and look at the eating patterns overall that are health promoting or not, and being able to really like leave those moral judgments of foods behind. So the journey has been as much about building something that I hope helps people improve their diet quality without engaging in diet culture, as it has been about me doing the same thing personally.
It's so interesting. You're like the anti-diet person, and but yet you're talking all about nutrition and all that. So I really appreciate that. The dogma that we can get, and especially people who are vulnerable with an illness or trying to lose weight or whatever, it must be so hard. I love to play around with diets, and I'm trying this and trying that just for fun. Not necessarily I have this issue, but there was one time I stuck really hard with a diet, and it was the lectin-free diet. And I actually had a radical change because I felt a lot of inflammation, and I had my hips were bothering me. And I don't know, I'm still trying to figure it out. It's like, but it must have been something else, or it must have been something. It can't happen that quickly. But because I felt a dramatic shift like within 24 hours, I was like, wow, I got to stick with this to see, because I'm afraid of this pain to come back. And I don't have autoimmune disease, or I can imagine if you really feel stabbing pain, if you're really struggling with gut issues. And I actually could feel what they were talking about, because I stuck with it for 3 months, like pretty strict. And it's friggin' hard to do that. And I started to understand the mentality of fear of food. I never feared food, but I was like, oh my God, I'm afraid to eat that tomato. I was like, I'm afraid to eat a friggin' tomato. How is that even possible? And I appreciate I went through this, because then I have a bit more empathy for people who do. And I eventually, you know, could start eating things that brought it back in. And I'm like, I don't know. I don't think it's lectins, because I don't feel anything anymore. But that's how I found your book, The Autoimmune Protocol one, because I told my trainer, who saw me walking, limping into the gym, trying to fix my hips, and he saw me just scooting on over at that problem. He's like, you should read this book. And I ate up your book. It was like super thick, so comprehensive, but I thought that was beyond what I needed. But I learned so much about nutrients and the foods and all that, and I see it, and then how that led you to what you're doing now with Nutrabor, and how, gosh, I would not want to be so restricted ever again. And my heart goes out to people who do, but I hope that maybe through your system that people can, even when they have to be somewhat careful of the foods that they eat, they can still find plenty of nutrients and abundance and joy in all the other foods that should be available to them. Is that where I'm going? I mean, is that correct, what they're going to find?
I consider Nutrivore a dietary philosophy rather than a diet itself. So what I've created is a nutritional sciences education that people can use to understand what foods that align with whatever they want to do diet-wise are going to help supply the nutrients that their bodies need. So it is a diet modifier. You can apply Nutrivore principles to however you eat now. And it doesn't negate restrictions for medical reasons, right? I have celiac disease. I can't eat gluten. I still avoid gluten. And it doesn't stop me from getting all of the nutrients that my body needs from the foods that I eat. So avoiding foods for medical reasons is that's a whole separate, or for religious reasons or ideological convictions, right? That is a whole separate category compared to, for me, I had dietary restrictions that were learned based on the diet that I was trying, that I, saw success with. And I, talking about you sort of feeling a lot less pain on a diet when you cut out a lot of foods. When you cut out a lot of foods, you also eat something else, right? And I think a lot of these diets at least work initially because of the foods that we're eating, right? Because of the foods that we're adding, not the foods that we're taking away. Sometimes they work because they help you identify a food allergy or intolerance that you didn't know was there. That was certainly my case. I did not know that I was so gluten intolerant until I, started a diet that was grain-free and gluten-free. So I think, one of the things that happens though in these types of diets that are defined based on this list of foods that you're going to avoid, right? Not very many of them also say, and eat this. Most of them just say, don't eat all of these things, is we start to view that list of foods as bad. And then one of the things that happens is when you see some success on a restrictive diet, I certainly fell down this personally as well, you credit the things you cut out for that success. And then when you hit the wall, right, you start to backslide, you start to have more symptoms, or you start gaining weight, you start, the yo-yo cycle again. However you're measuring success, when you're no longer seeing that success, if you think that you got that initial success because you cut out a ton of foods, the very, very natural human nature next thing is to go, okay, well, now what else do I need to cut out? So I'm going to cut out more foods. And then I'm going to do the more restrictive diet and then the more restrictive diet. And we are seeing a rise in popularity of some of the most restrictive eating plans that have ever been presented in human history. And it comes from the way we have defined diets for the last 50, 60 years, right? Low this, no this, right? And so it's basically digging this even deeper nutritional hole for us. Most people don't get all of the nutrients their bodies need. Something like 90% of Americans are not getting enough of 5 essential nutrients. Half of Americans aren't getting enough of 10 essential nutrients. Most people are not getting all the nutrients that their bodies need, and that increases risk of everything that can go wrong with us health-wise. It erodes quality of life. All of the symptoms that are oh, this is so annoying, I'm not sleeping well, or I have a headache, or I feel tired, the risk of those all increase with dietary shortfalls. And that's different than dietary deficiency. Deficiency is a disease of malnutrition, like scurvy or rickets or pellagra. A dietary insufficiency is I'm above that level. I'm getting enough vitamin C to not get scurvy, but I'm not meeting the recommended dietary intake of vitamin C. And what happens is we're not getting the nutritional resources that our bodies need to be healthy, to do all of the things that all of our cells do. And it's like a wear and tear type impact on our health. It's a nickel and diming effect. And what it does is it interacts with other factors, it interacts with environmental exposures, with genetics, with age, with stress levels, right, health behaviors, diet quality. It interacts with all of these other things to increase risk for disease. And it basically is just another contributor in this melting soup of destruction that is our risk factor for chronic disease. But a really clear point of intervention. So for me, Nutrivore is just about understanding that system, understanding what nutrients we need. And if you have reasons to follow a specific diet, Nutrivore is still a really important education for you to have to make sure that you're getting the nutrients you need from your diet, especially if you're only eating a limited number of foods. And Nutrivore also helps you identify, maybe you're cutting out all food sources of some important nutrients. It helps you identify what those are so that you can now, you know, talk to your doctor or registered dietitian and figure out a strategy to make sure you're getting those nutrients, right? That's when you can bring in some professionals to help you figure that out. But the education base to even identify that comes from what I'm building with Nutrivore.
It's such a comprehensive database for nutrition and nutrients, foods. It's incredible. And I think in a way too, you've tried to make it easy for people by giving people a score or a food or a certain ingredient has a score. And so we want to get more of these higher scored foods as we can if we want to really get all our nutrients in. And I think that's such a clever idea. And it is a great resource. You need to know where vitamin C is, or you need to know how to build your plate. It's so great. So I know it's a lifetime of work that has gone into it, because it's not just what you've been doing the last several years, but it's been your lifetime. But it is not something that at least the way it looks like to me is that you were still, at least at the time, last time I was looking at it, you were still putting things in there and you're constantly updating it.
We're adding 3, 4, or 5 articles a week still to the site. I think it'll take a few years to build out the full vision, but what's there now is 500-ish articles. There's enough to get lost in for days, if not weeks. There's a huge body of just education there already. And an even longer to-do list of things to add. So for example, if you're interested in learning about a food and what nutrients it contains and what those nutrients do, and that food is not on the Nutrivore site, come back later. It's almost certainly, if you're interested in it, we're probably interested in it too. It's almost certainly on the to-do list.
Foods, that ingredients that people normally don't even know what they are. And I may encounter them on my travels. I'm a nomad and I go all throughout the world and I find, I don't know, some crazy ingredient and you have it, and which is amazing. So you do go in deep. It's not just the basic foods that in the Western diet. It's actually a database for a lot of different cultures.
This episode is sponsored by Oxford HealthSpan, the creators of my favorite supplement, Primadine. I admit it, I am a total supplement junkie, but if I had to choose only one, it would be this one. And it's because Primadine is spermidine, and this is shown to activate autophagy, which is super important. Now, this is a cellular cleanup and recycling process that declines as we age. So as we get older, our cells accumulate a lot of junk and waste, which isn't good for our cells, our health, nor our longevity. So we need to clean it up. And if you want the research on this, go to oxfordhealthspan.com and you can see all of it, showing how spermidine supports our brain, our hormones, and our heart health. And another great side effect is stronger hair, skin, and nails, but also longer eyelashes. But you know, the real important reason why I love Primadine is because I have never, ever received as much feedback on a product I recommended as I have with Primadine. Literally every week, someone reaches out to me on Facebook or Instagram with an amazing testimonial. And most of the time, it's about improved sleep. And even some of you told me it's reversed a bit of your gray hair too. So I find that totally amazing. So I can honestly say with 100% certainty that Primadine is the best spermidine supplement you'll ever find. And you can try it with a 15% discount by using the code Zora, Z-O-R-A, on oxfordhealthspan.com. Just be sure to get back to me with your results too. Now enjoy the show.
So let's talk about this transformation that we go through when we're entering menopause. And there's some women who literally sail through it and they have no symptoms whatsoever, don't notice any change in their bodies. And that's one end of the spectrum. And then you have the other side who just having hot flashes, mood swings, depression, changes in their body composition, fatigue, and they get them all at once. It can be the other side of the spectrum, which is just absolutely crazy. But you mentioned, I think it was in a post, that 42% of postmenopausal females have depression. Is there anything that nutrition can do to help us out of this state, or even lower our risk of getting there in the first place while we're going through this transition?
Menopausal depression is one of the symptoms of menopause that we don't talk a lot about, right? Depression is still pretty taboo. There's so many other things that we struggle with in the menopausal periods that are miserable. And we tend not to necessarily link depression with, right? Like, it's hard to sort of think of, like, what's the connection with hot flash and depression? Well, it's not enough estrogen and progesterone, right? It's how our sex hormones are impacting our neurobiology. And it can cause this, right, amazing spectrum of experiences. But risk about doubles during the perimenopausal period for depression. So your risk of having depression is about twice as much in menopause as it is premenopause.
And it's even higher if you've had a previous bout of depression as well. So it puts even more at risk. Crazy.
And it also tends to go in hand with menopause insomnia. So if you're experiencing night sweats, hot flashes at night, or any other like sleep disruption through perimenopause or menopause, then also your risk of depressive symptoms are higher there as well. And that's because there's this close link between sleep and mental health. So it's I think a really common experience, right? Nearly half of menopausal females experience this, and yet it's not talked about.
And a lot of people, I've met a lot of women who, when I do these interviews around the world, that they will say, in hindsight, now that I'm out on the other end, I realized I was depressed because of the hormones. And right. Now when they've balanced out, but when you're in it, you don't really make that association. So I really hope that, you know, at least somebody who's listening now can at least be aware of you're not going crazy. And certainly life throws you lemons too when you get to this age, and you may find that you have good reason to be depressed. It's not like, you know, nothing happened, but sometimes we find it harder to handle without some of those hormones around. So I really don't go talk to your doctor about hormones and your depression and consider that perhaps could be a part of the contributing factor.
Yeah. So I love what you just said, which is that there is still the first line treatment for menopause depression is still antidepressants, right? So we can talk about how vitamin B6 is so strongly linked and can be very supportive. Interestingly, very specifically for menopause insomnia and menopause depression, but that's an adjunct to talking with your doctor, talking with them about estrogen hormone replacement therapy, talking about potentially an SSRI or another category of medication for the depression. But there's a really strong link between vitamin B6 intake and depressive symptoms, and actually menopause insomnia in menopausal females. There was a study done, 2020, I think, that looked at 43 different nutrients in the diet and how they were associated with depressive symptoms in menopausal women. And the only nutrient that was strongly associated was vitamin B6. And that's because what vitamins do in the body is they tend to act as coenzymes, which means that they are a nutrient that are required for an enzyme to do its job. And enzymes are they are the main workers in life. Like what they do is they make a chemical reaction happen. So that chemical reaction might be making something really important. So in vitamin B6's case, vitamin B6 is required for enzymes that are important in neurotransmitter production, and especially serotonin, dopamine, GABA, and melatonin. So the four main neurotransmitters that are associated with sleep disturbance and depression and anxiety. And so when you don't have enough vitamin B6, like this happens in all phases of life, low vitamin B6 intake does increase risk of mental health challenges and sleep disturbances. And there've been studies, for example, where they just give you more B6 and you sleep more, 20 or 30 minutes more. It's not a huge, huge difference, But like just that one nutrient as a point of intervention is really fascinating.
And if you're waking up at 5:30 in the morning, that extra half hour, I think can make a big difference, no?
Makes a huge difference. Yeah. Unless you need to get up at 5:30, which is what time I get up. And in which case, I would like to get the other half hour at the other side of the night.
Yeah.
Been a bunch of studies where they have looked at vitamin B6. Usually, I mean, in studies, but they always do it in supplement form rather than food form, just because that helps standardize like how much people are getting. It's a much simpler a sort of experiment set up to be able to test a hypothesis. But they've shown, you know, that getting more vitamin B6 can drop the risk of depressive symptoms by 20-ish%, which is that's a big, like that is a big magnitude of effect. And interestingly, like vitamin B6 doesn't seem to be particularly helpful for the other, right? It doesn't seem to be helpful for hot flashes. But also estrogen replacement therapy does not seem to be particularly helpful for depressive symptoms. So they really kind of go together. And again, not a substitute for SSRIs, adjunct here. And some of the best sources of vitamin B6 is poultry.
Poultry. Chicken. That's the best source that gets a high nutrivore score.
Yeah. Any poultry, any part, any bird.
Oh, good. I'm eating a lot of that lately because I've been tested for heavy metals and I'm supposed to stop eating seafood for a while. So not going to be long because I love it. So I'm just want to get my levels down. So I'm eating a lot of chicken. But again, I don't want to be restrictive, right? This is not a forever thing, but it just kind of sucks when doctor tells you, let's be cool it on the fish. So then it's interesting, the B6 as well, I imagine is really good for the adrenals and the thyroid, because so many women I know going through menopause or perimenopause, a functional medicine doctor would so often throw B vitamins at them and say, look, you know, got to protect the adrenals, or you got to, you know, help your body with all these nutrients. And I guess that's one.
It's also one of the nutrients that are strongly associated with cognition and age-related cognitive decline. B6, B9, and B12 are really like the three B vitamins that have the strongest association with basically memory, you know, how we problem solve. They've got all different kinds of like really cool little tests that they do to measure that in these scientific studies. So it's not just like a screening test for, you know, cognitive decline or dementia. They do really interesting tests. There's one called like the trail making task, where you like have to draw lines between different numbers in order, like as fast as you can. And then you get another one where the numbers are all in a different place and you have to do it again. There's like so many fascinating little measurements that they can do to test different types of memory, different types of like cognitive function. And there's a pretty strong link between B vitamin intake, but especially B6, B9, and B12, and age-related cognitive decline, as well as dementia risk for Alzheimer's disease. So with B6, you get multiple different benefits for things that feel a lot closer once you go through menopause. You start thinking about, oh, okay, now that we've gone through this change of life or whatever euphemism, you know, what's now I need to start thinking about these other things. Like it feels a little bit closer, doesn't it?
It does. It does. And I think when it hits you, or if it hits you hard, then even more so. And I'm wondering then, so with the B, say, let's say someone listening now is thinking, oh, maybe I'm a little depressed, I'll go talk to my doctor, but yet how can I support that with nutrients or with food or with supplements? What would you recommend? Is somebody go eat a ton of chicken, or should they go buy a supplement or something else? And what will they find if they do this? Like, give an example, someone goes to Nutrivore, and how would they even look for that on your website?
Let's start there. So go to Nutrivore.com, click on the nutrients button, and that's going to take you to the side of the website that teaches you all about what nutrients do in the body. So then click on vitamins, and then click on vitamin B6 or B9 or B12. That will tell you like not just how B6 is associated with menopause depression, but like all of the cool different things that vitamin B6 does and all the different chronic diseases that low vitamin B6 intake is associated with. It'll talk about what happens if you're actually deficient or if you get too much. It'll link to a huge set of this section of the site that talks, that's just like the dietary reference intakes, which was surprisingly hard to collate because that information doesn't exist all in one place very easily on the internet, but it does now on Nutrivore. And then you have all of the best and good sources of vitamin B6. And it's dynamic. So as we add foods to the site, these sections are like automatically updated. So you'll have a section of the best food sources. So that's anything that has 50% or more daily value per serving. And it'll list all of them that we have on the site so far. And then good sources is between 10 and 50% daily value per serving. And then you can do that for all the other nutrients. And you can kind of fall down that rabbit hole. You can go click on the food and learn more about the food. You can go click on the nutrient, learn more about the nutrient. And you can find recipes that use those foods. So we're really trying to create an educational ecosystem where you can learn both the like theoretical knowledge as well as like the practical knowledge to be able to implement Nutrivore. So with vitamin B6, poultry is some of our best sources. With folate, since we're talking about B9 and B12, for B9, legumes, like pulse legumes, like lentils, are some of our best sources. And for vitamin B12, I mean, people tend to think of red meat because it is a good source of B12. But even better than that is mollusks, shellfish like oysters and mussels and clams. Those are the top sources of vitamin B12.
Yeah, I must have had tons of that before. And so then would you say, you don't cover actual supplements on your site, do you? Or you won't go,
no,
hey, this is a time to supplement. If you can't get your score up.
So I'm not, so I will just say that supplements in general are outside of what I'm trying to build. So I'm really trying to build a food-centered approach to getting the nutrients we need. That doesn't mean that I'm anti-supplement. I do have an article on Nutrivore.com going over the science on multivitamins because it's very underwhelming. We just don't see the health benefit that you would expect from a multivitamin. So we don't see reductions in all-cause mortality, which is a general indicator of health and longevity and just kind of a broad way to measure whether or not something is good or bad for us overall. We don't see reductions in cardiovascular disease incidence or cardiovascular disease mortality or cancer incidence. And you would expect, those are like the big ones, right? You would expect when a supplement or a food is beneficial, you kind of expect to see a signal in those outcomes, even if it's mainly good for something else, right? So we're talking about B6. We say this is mainly good for things happening in our brain, right? Like production of serotonin and dopamine and GABA. It's really important for cognition. So, you know, we have this effect over here. You would still expect to see some kind of signal in these other like really big health outcomes because cancer and cardiovascular disease and all-cause mortality are sensitive to everything we do, like all of the nutrients and all of the different foods. So normally you can see a signal, and we don't see that with multivitamins. So I'm more in favor of like a targeted supplementation approach. So working with your doctor or a registered dietitian or other, you know, healthcare provider to figure out like what specifically you need more of than you can get from your diet. Is there a food strategy? That's where like Nutrivore will give you the information. If there's a need beyond a food strategy, then that's where I would rather than making these blanket recommendations for supplements, because I just think it's so individual. I can show you what foods these nutrients are in. If you think you might need a supplement, I'd far rather you work with a healthcare provider who knows your history, knows your test results, knows your goals, and can tailor a recommendation just for you.
Well, most people I speak to in this nutrition space or biohacking space, they do all tend to agree that food first, supplements second. You know, that's called a supplement for a reason. It's to add on to an already healthy diet and lifestyle. And one thing I think is interesting, maybe you've heard of this before, but I was listening to some doctors and researchers who were talking about supplements, like a multivitamin. I think it was mostly about multivitamins. And there was discussion about how some people actually, they really feel better on taking some multivitamins and they start to get healthy. And what the scientist was saying, who's created this supplement, said, well, we don't really know if it's the supplement or it's actually that people who start to take supplements start to adopt healthy diet and lifestyle. Cause they're like, that's it. I'm going to get healthy. Let's start by putting this vitamin in my mouth. And you know, which if that's a precursor to having a change in your diet and lifestyle, great. But is it the multivitamin? I don't know. And does it really matter if you're just getting healthy? I don't know. Maybe it doesn't matter. I don't know.
I think that's a very insightful comment from somebody who's making a multivitamin to actually be able to make that statement. I think that's like honest marketing. I think that's admirable. I mean, certainly there's a correlation between people who take a multivitamin and who are making other changes in their diet and lifestyle. There's other possible explanations, though, for why multivitamin doesn't yield the expected health benefit. Like we know those nutrients, if you're not getting enough, it increases risk of disease. We also know that if you're taking multivitamin, we can see, oh, look, like all of those nutrients came back up, but there's some question as to how much of it we're actually absorbing. So tablets especially don't fully dissolve typically until they hit the large intestine, which is like too far down the gastrointestinal tract. Most of those nutrients are absorbed in the small intestine. So there is a certain amount that's just going straight through and not being absorbed into our bodies. And it may be different with like different formulas, different types of tablets, like different digestive tracts, right? How efficient your digestion is, whether or not you take it with food would be a big contributor there. So one explanation is like, maybe we're not actually getting much of those nutrients. Another explanation that I think is pretty good, that makes sense in my brain, is the forms that we have in supplements are not always the same forms that we see in foods. And in foods, you tend to have nutrient synergy. So you tend to have a collection of nutrients that work together to increase absorption or to prevent, you know, they have some kind of competitive binding in a really advantageous way. So they prevent like absorbing too much of something. And that just really isn't part of how multivitamins are formulated. So we don't tend to have the synergy of nutrients. So we might have them like competing for binding in a way that's disadvantageous. Because it means we're not absorbing what we actually need. Or you have forms that are just not as usable by the body. Another really, I think, sensible explanation is there's things missing in our diet that aren't formulated into multivitamins. So for example, we don't put fiber into multivitamins. We don't put polyphenols. There's some multivitamins have plant extracts in, but it's such a small amount compared to what we could have gotten from just eating more fruits and vegetables, for example. So it's not really enough to have a big impact. It's just enough to be able to put something on, you know, on the sales page. And so it may be that, you know, the things that are in a multivitamin are not meeting enough of the different shortfalls to actually make a difference. Like maybe we just need more vitamin D and more fiber and more polyphenols and more omega-3 fats compared to what is in like a standard multivitamin supplement. So I think there's a lot of other potential explanations for why they don't help on average. And also that's all of the data is on average. So there's no, I haven't seen any studies that go, let's look at this brand of multivitamin versus this brand and see if there's a difference. So we don't actually know, like, is there a perfectly formulated multivitamin out there that's super beneficial? Like maybe there is. And it's important to say they're not harmful either, other than if you're getting too much calcium from them. That does increase risk of cancer a little bit. But overall, there's no harm in a multivitamin either. It's just that they cost money. And a lot of us don't have the money to like both get the have all of the supplements and then also have all of the good quality foods. And I would always say the choice is a multivitamin, again, not talking about targeted supplementation that your doctor recommends, but if the choice is a multivitamin or some fresh fruits and vegetables from the grocery store, you're going to for sure see the benefit from the fresh fruits and vegetables that you're not going to see from the multivitamin.
What about, speaking of supplements, spermidine? And I don't know if you've heard of it. I think last time I checked your site, I don't know if I came across it or not. I don't remember if you have it now, but it's found in a lot of other foods that are in the Japanese diet. But do you have any thoughts about spermidine, whether it's food form or from a supplement?
I know little enough that I probably should not speak on it. I like to kind of stick with topics that are like I have the knowledge base to support what I'm saying. I know very little. Like I've heard of it, and I've seen some of the interesting research showing benefits. But I think there was a paper I think last year that showed that high dose spermidine supplementation didn't increase the levels in our body. So to me, it seems based on what I do know that it's still a topic for which a lot more research needs to be done to either figure out a better supplement strategy that does actually increase our levels and or a food strategy that is more effective. So interesting, but based on what I know, my interpretation is not yet enough for me to go out and get a spermidine supplement for sure.
But there's always the food, which is, as I understand, natto and mushrooms and a lot of stuff that's happens to be in a Japanese diet. So I think it's obviously it's always good to get that from the food. And if not, what to mention, yeah, the higher doses of spermidine. I'm wondering if some of those studies, I've seen a lot of supplements coming out now with crazy high doses. And you're like, this should cost a fortune because, you know, 1 milligram is like $100, and how can you have 5 milligrams? And as I understand, actually a lot of stuff that's going on in the supplement industry, especially with spermidine, because it's such a hot new ingredient right now that people kind of want because of the autophagy effects, is people are using synthetics. They're washing stuff out. They're sprouting and artificially creating higher doses of spermidine, and there aren't any studies really showing comparing like what is the real deal versus the synthetic. And so I hope people who are on the fence about it be very mindful, be very critical if something says more than 1 milligram of spermidine, and then just go and get it from just learn how to eat natto. Like
super plug mushrooms here, because mushrooms have unique types of fiber that we can't get in other vegetables, because mushrooms are fungi and other vegetables are plants that are really beneficial for the gut microbiome. But mushrooms have ergothionine, which is an amino acid that has been nicknamed the longevity vitamin, that has really strong anti-aging benefits. It reduces the risk of all of the chronic conditions associated with aging, and it seems to have a life-extending effect. And funnily enough, you do get some from natto and tempeh, but our best food source by a million miles is mushrooms. And studies show that countries where they eat more mushrooms have longer lifespans on average. So you're not going to go wrong with mushrooms.
Do you remember the Nutrivore score of that one? I don't know, mushrooms. And there's so many different kinds, but.
Yeah, I mean, they range from around 1500 for like white mushrooms, I think are 1833. And then they go up to the 4,000s. So like a shiitake or a maitake are in the 4,500-ish range, which is crazy high. So to put that into perspective, any food with a Nutrivore score over 150 delivers more nutrients than the calories it contributes to the diet. So when you're talking about something in the thousands, that's like, it's just such a nutrient dense food.
I love mushrooms. I ate them every day, sometimes multiple times a day. And when I go to Asia, I just flew in last week, and the variety is incredible. It seems as even in, I'm in Europe now, and in the US, we don't have the variety of mushrooms that they have in Asia. And I hope that changes.
I recommend taking like a mushroom foraging class, or like finding a buddy who knows how. Like, you don't want to forage mushrooms if you don't know what you're doing, because poisonous mushrooms, that's not good. So you really need to be like 100% confident in your identification of a mushroom before you eat it. Not 99.9%, has to be 100%. If you're not 100%, don't do it. But I've, you know, in just my woods here, I take my dog for a hike every morning, and there's 8 varieties of wild mushrooms that I am confident in my identification enough to pick and bring home and cook and feed my family. And they're all, well, oyster mushrooms are that's the only variety out of all of those that I can sometimes find at the grocery store. Everything else is a variety of mushroom that I've never seen anywhere.
Oh, wow. That's where did you say you're living?
I live in Georgia, in North Georgia.
Georgia. Okay. Oh my gosh. Amazing.
Hey, I'm butting in for a quick second. If you enjoy the content brought to you in this podcast, consider supporting Hack My Age by becoming a patron on patreon.com. This is where you can drop a tip or become a member for the price of a coffee. Members get special material, free coaching, and private Zoom calls. Join us by going to patreon.com. That's patreon.com/hackmyage. Thanks for your support. Now let's get back to the podcast.
So let's move on. We have, I feel like 10 minutes left. So, and I'm only in question three.
Oh dear.
So, okay, let's move to sort of macronutrients, because most of the women I speak to are going through this menopause transition. They complain about losing their muscle mass, right? So much harder to build it, and it just seems to go away. And they find it, sometimes the belly fat comes on much easier than the muscle. What can we do during peri and postmenopause from a nutritional standpoint to prevent this from happening?
Or at least minimize how much it happens. So I saw one paper that showed that on average, females lose 10% of their muscle mass through just the perimenopausal period. And of course, sarcopenia, which is loss of muscle, is a major risk factor for frailty as we age and like falling and breaking a hip. And right, like it's not cool. It's definitely something that we want to try to avoid. So the two things, the two action items that have been shown again and again and again in scientific literature to minimize sarcopenia is activity, especially muscle strengthening activity, and getting enough protein. And this has been shown in postmenopausal females as well as just older people in general. And different studies have looked at protein intake in different ways. So there have been studies that show like, oh, if you increase protein intake by 40%, that reduces the loss of muscle. I feel like because we all start at a different intake level, that's not as meaningful as the studies that look at protein intake in grams per kilogram body weight. Requires us to do a little bit of math, not as much fun. But 1.2 grams per kilogram body weight seems to be the sort of minimum level of protein intake for a menopausal, perimenopausal or menopausal female, as well as anyone over the age of 60, regardless of gender, for that level to be to prevent sarcopenia. So 1.2 grams, the way that you would calculate, you would figure out your weight in kilograms. So if you take your weight in pounds and divide by 2.2 and just ask your phone to do it, and then multiply that by 1.2, and that will give you a number of grams of protein per day. So it might be something like 80, 100, 120 grams of protein per day, depending on how heavy you are. And what's really cool is a brand new science from just the last couple of months that show it doesn't really matter. Like we used to think that you could only absorb so much protein per meal. And now it's been shown that we can actually utilize quite a lot more protein than that. So it doesn't, you don't actually have to go, okay, my goal is 90 grams of protein per day, I have to have 30 grams at each meal. You can have a little bit more at one meal and a little bit less at another meal. We don't need to be quite so like regimented about it. But that combined with strength training at least twice per week, and that can be, strength training can be, doesn't have to be like in the gym with weights, right? Strength training can be calisthenics. It could be gardening, right? Like any body type weight of activity that builds muscle, body weight exercises. It can be even like hiking up a hill it's only going to be lower body mainly, but even hiking up a hill is going to count as strength training activity in addition to cardio. So most types of activity that you'll do will kind of hit both cardio and strength training. And it could be something like Tai Chi or yoga, right? Like there's lots of different things that strengthen our muscles, but making sure that there's some activity during the week that is geared towards that, along with protein intake, are the two best things for sarcopenia.
And about nutrients, and the way I understand it, the most nutrient dense proteins would be organ meats, like liver, kidneys.
Organ meats and shellfish are actually about tied. Like liver, kidney, heart are the best. They're the organ meats that have the most complete nutrition data sets. But oysters, mussels, and clams are right up there. Crab is right up there. Squid and octopus is right up there. So they're actually really comparable, and they're actually very comparable in the types of nutrients they have, along with being high quality protein. So I think shellfish is a much easier sell for most people than organ meat. So we're gonna go with just eat some delicious like mussels. Yeah.
Unless you're in muscles France or in Europe, they make liver pretty good. I'm a liver fan.
That's true.
I can eat hearts and kidneys. I have no problem with that. But I think it really just depends on how you cook it. If you don't cook it well, just like anything, you don't know how to cook it, it's going to taste bad. So.
Oh, and we've lost so much cultural knowledge on how to cook organ meat because they haven't been a part of like the regular like American diet for 80 years was like the last time steak and kidney pie was like every Sunday, right? Like,
it's crazy. I hope that changes, and or at least people can learn how to like it. But so that's great. So we can get more protein. Would you say in terms of getting grams of protein in, if somebody really wants to pack it in, what are the best sources if they want to? Let's say if they want to eat a ton, but they want to eat just a little bit, but they want a big bang for their buck when they eat it.
Lean meats in general, I mean, they have the reputation for being great protein sources because they're great protein sources. That could be like chicken breast or white fish. I mean, they're pretty comparable. Most like animal foods are going to be 20 to maybe up to about 30 grams of protein for a 100 gram serving. Shrimp is very, very high protein and very, very lean. So most of them are going to be in that range. But you can also get actually very similar amount of protein from tofu, from any kind of soy product. You're not that much farther behind from something like lentils or beans. So, and plant protein absolutely counts towards your protein goals. We don't really see amino acid deficiencies in people who eat like multiple different foods, right? So as long as you're getting your protein from a bunch of different sources, you don't really need to think about complete proteins or essential and versus non-essential amino acids. If you're getting enough protein and that enough protein comes from at least a few different foods, chances are very good. You don't need to worry about whether or not you got enough of whatever amino acid.
So let's take in consideration a woman, again, who's going through the menopause. What are the top, I don't know, 5-10 foods that you would say she should include in her diet?
If you think about just like the nutrients that are beneficial, like I know we didn't have time to talk about osteoporosis, but that's obviously another big concern for menopausal females, in which case calcium, vitamin D, and vitamin K are your like top nutrient targets. So I would say, and then also thinking about like risk of dementia and the importance of long-chain omega-3 fats. So I would say our like top foods are some kind of leafy vegetable. That's going to be some of our best sources of vitamin K. Studies show that improves bone health as well as slows age-related cognitive decline. Seafood is going to be like the next like big target food because of seafood is just super high in all of the B vitamins and really important minerals, as well as having those long-chain omega-3 fats. And then I would throw in something like poultry, right, for just the protein, as well as the vitamin B6, and being like some kind of lentils, some kind of legume, lentils or chickpeas or beans, because of the B vitamins, as well as the really beneficial fiber. And it also helps get those, that protein up. So I would say those would be like my top four. No, let's throw in mushrooms. Top five.
Yay!
Let's throw in mushrooms. Yeah. I would say those would be my top targets. And you could back it up and just say vegetables, right? Include some leafy vegetables and some mushrooms. Vegetables in general are the most nutrient dense foods we can eat. And there's so much science showing that eating a diet abundant in vegetables improves our health in multiple different ways.
Yeah. So I'm thinking of a plate, as you were saying the foods, I'm thinking of a plate. So I'm thinking probably spinach with some salmon. When you say chicken, maybe a big green, dark leafy green salad with some chicken on it. What about breakfast? How does a woman get some of these for her breakfast? I mean, I'm actually crazy. I do the mushroom and the stir fry and the chicken, the dark, the kale and cabbage for breakfast, but I know not a people are not like me. What would you recommend?
So I will share my weird breakfast that is my favorite breakfast. So for me, what makes breakfast breakfast is A, it's the first meal I eat of the day, and it needs to be something easy. Like, because I'm not going to take a lot of time to cook breakfast, especially on a weekday when I need to be out of the house and driving teenagers to whatever places. So for me, the things that the properties that make breakfast breakfast, it's not a collection of foods, right? It's not toast and muffins and breakfast cereal. It is that it's something easy. And I just think you cannot beat the ease of leftovers. And my favorite leftovers for breakfast is soup. I actually typically, especially this time of year, make a big batch on the weekend, and that is my breakfast all week long. And that is an amazing way to get in all of these foods, right? Lentil soup is delicious. Chicken vegetable soup is delicious. There's so many different recipes for like a pureed green soup. I love lettuce soup, but you could do like a, you know, pureed spinach soup. Like there's so many different options out there, and I make a different soup every week. So I like to mix it up. So I realize it's not the most normal of breakfasts, but it is one that makes getting all of these things easy. And it does satisfy the criteria of being something fast to get on a weekday.
And it got the protein, fats, and fiber to keep you satiated for a long time. And soup is super satiating. And that's very Asian. Like whenever I go to Asia, it's like everybody's eating soup for breakfast. And then I jump on the bandwagon when I'm out there too. So you're right. It's why don't we learn from some of these other cultures too? And throwing those mushrooms in as well. So good idea. Thank you. Well, let's inspire women to start doing savory breakfasts and the leftovers. I think that's a good key as well. So we're going to have to let you go soon. And before I ask my last question, is there anything that we haven't covered yet? I know there's probably a ton, but is there anything you really wanted to get in before I let you go?
I think the big thing I want to mention is that I have a new book coming in May called Nutrivore, The Radical New Science for Getting the Nutrients You Need from the Food You Eat. And it is everything that we've talked about today. It is there's a section on B6 and menopause depression and menopause insomnia. There's a section on protein for sarcopenia. There's a section on vitamin K for osteoporosis. There's actually 27 different examinations of the link between a specific nutrient and a health complaint. And so it's basically is building the case for Nutrivore by presenting nutritional solutions to whatever health challenges you have. And so I'm really excited.
When does it come out?
Coming May 14th, and it's available for pre-order. May 14th.
May 14th, 2024. And it's available for pre-order now. We can pre-order it now. Oh gosh, I'm sorry. I didn't get this information. Yeah. Thank you for mentioning that. I'm glad I asked.
That's all right. That was the purpose of this question. So I'm glad I had something to say.
So I will need that link. Please send that to me so I can have that in the show notes too. And everyone can find you at Nutrivore.com. And I love your TikToks and your Instagrams. I'll have links to that as well. You're on YouTube. You've got honestly so much information. I learned so much from you, and I appreciate all the work that you do. And before I let you go, do you have any last words for a woman going through the menopause transition?
Get the estrogen. Get the estrogen. I can't tell you once I finally like met the criteria for estrogen hormone replacement therapy, how much of the little things that I had been dealing with and not really associating with menopause, how much all of those things improved. And science now shows that it, you know, especially if you're getting it in that window of fairly shortly after menopause and before the age of 60, that it reduces risk of cardiovascular disease. It reduces risk of most types of cancer. Like it also has a huge, it's not just about quality of life. It's about health, beyond that. So the science on estrogen replacement therapy has changed a lot in the last 20 years. So I'm a big fan. And for me personally, being able to start estrogen was like, aha, okay. Got it. You do have to wait until your ovaries really finally give up the ghost. But it's there's still this like idea out there that it's not good, and we need to get rid of that. We need to help people understand that estrogen replacement therapy should be the standard of care for all of us.
It's amazing you said estrogen, because just last week I dialed up my estrogen and wow, the sleep. I mean, I was getting pretty good sleep.
I did too. Like 2 weeks ago, we're on the same estrogen upping time frame. Yeah.
Yeah. It's crazy. One of the just recent posts I made on Instagram was from Carol Peterson, who's a compounding pharmacist. And she said, don't settle for less. And her point was don't settle like to suboptimal sleep or suboptimal whatever, just a little pain and a little joint pain or a little bit. It's okay. no, like you can feel so amazing. And when you said estrogen, I was like, yes, that's exactly where I'm at. So thank you so much for sharing that. And thank you so much for your time and your expertise, the work that you've done. It's huge. Please, everyone go to see Nutrivore.com. You're going to be blown away by the resources. And I hope to have you on again so we can talk a little bit more. And I appreciate you so much. Have a good
thank
day.
You so much for having me again. You too.
Hey, did you enjoy the podcast? Don't forget to subscribe to be notified of all the new episodes and leave a review to help build the tribe. It's a small act of kindness that brings me big benefits and helps others find this amazing content. The best thing you can do is share. Sharing is caring. Statements made on this podcast have not been evaluated by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Anything we say or products we mention are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Information provided by this podcast is not a substitute for personal medical advice and not intended to replace a one-on-one relationship with a qualified healthcare professional. It is intended as a sharing of knowledge and information from the personal research and experience of me and my guests.